G'day everybody and welcome to the show, and today's guest is Paul Harris and Craig Campobasso. Have I got your last name right, Craig?
Yes, Campobasso.
Campobasso. All good, all good. Now, I'll just go to each one of you to start off with. Paula, you've been in this field for a long time. You've actually done work with Allan Hynek, assisting him back in the 80s. You helped to get Colonel Philip J. Corso's book, The Day After Oswald, out in Italian, but that's just very small, minuscule to the wide range of work that you've done for many, many years. So I just want the listeners and viewers to know that just a little bit about your background. Would you like to tell us a little bit more than what I've just said?
Yes, and by the way, Craig Campobasso is Italian like me.
As well, yeah, I was thinking about pronouncing the name.
So it's a pleasure to be with you, Peter. And my background is 30 years in this field, since the 1980s, 1979, when I saw Close Encounters, and then I went to meet Allan Hynek, who, as you know, was Project Blue Book, but he also had the Center for UFO Studies. So I was trained by someone who had the great capacity to listen, to not make any judgments, and to tell me from working with him that this was all real. So it's not, do you believe in UFOs? It's like, yes, it's real. We've been working on 25 years of lights in the sky and physical traces cases and close encounters of the first, second, and third kind. But now I am at a point in my career, after having spoken to military witnesses, astronauts from NASA, geophysicists who were on the Bikini Atoll when UFOs flew over. All my five books are only interviews without any part of what I think. So 30 years worth of military, astronauts, policemen, people who'd worked in black ops projects, intelligence people, I have come to look at the contact scenario. And I think that's what I have in common with Craig Campobasso. I think it's important that I link it to him, because I did a lot of work in Italy on contact cases with human-type aliens. In particular, I'd like the listeners to go to the Pescara Amicizia, or friendship case, that took place in 1956, because I interviewed all the people there involved with that case, where the aliens actually made a deal to live with 10 Italians in the city of Pescara and interact with them. So you can go on YouTube and look up Amicizia, plus the most
fascinating case, that one.
Yeah, it's an alien case with people that are like 8 foot tall.
Is that still going today to some extent with some of the locals there?
No, it ended in 1970 and it's really interesting how it ended. I'm going to tell you this because it's very important people look it up on YouTube. It ended because those beings, and they used to call them C-56s, because those beings said, we can stay among you as long as you guys don't fight. We have a technology called UREDA, it's U-R-R-E-D-A, UREDA. It's a technology called harmony. And if we can stay in harmony with you, we can stay here. And those 10 Italians that were part of that were fine in the beginning, and then towards the end they started arguing and fighting, and the beings went home. I mean, that was an experiment that was done. And it was not only done in Pescara in Italy, it was done also in Chile. And I'm speaking to the people of Chile right now about that. In fact, I'm speaking to a lot of contactees in South America and Latin America. I'm speaking to Ricardo Gonzalez, Sixto Paz, Fernando Mostacio, Luis Fernando. These people are seeing human-type aliens or human-type people, like the Pescara case. So my connection to Craig and my connection to the current research I'm doing is I have to go back to the 1950s to study George Van Tassel, who had the runway there, who leased that runway at Giant Rock, and this is in the Yucca Valley in Southern California. I had to go back to George Adamski, who's really telling the truth, and George Adamski's contacts were amazing with Orthon. I had to go back to Howard Menger, the book is From Outer Space to You, for the contacts he had in Highbridge, New Jersey in 1956, and they were human-type aliens. And when I went back to Menger, and there were photographs of Howard Menger and Rose speaking to a group of people, there were three people sitting in that group that were not from here, and that is where I connect with Craig, because in that group of people, and there's about five photos of him, is a gentleman whose name is Val Thor, Valiant Thor, and that could lead into going to what Craig is involved with, because I went to Craig right away to talk about Frank Strangis and the background on Val Thor, who was a human type, who is a human type alien.
All right. Now, Craig, would you, you're a casting director and you've worked on many types of movies. Would you like to just give us a quick, you know, background on who you are, and also just go into how you got into the story?
Sure. I've been casting movies and television for 30 years, if you can believe it, and I still can't. But anyway, and I was in the business even before that. I actually got my start working on Frank Herbert's Dune, the original Dune that David Lynch directed. I actually worked on that film for 4 years and learned all about filmmaking there. So anyway, I when I was 26, I had a major spiritual awakening, and in my searches and travels and all of that, I came across the book Stranger at the Pentagon. I read it in the 80s, and I really resonated with the photographs in there of Valiant Thor. The other gentleman's name is Don, who is a vice commander on his flagship called Victor One, and the lady Jill, who is there with the blonde hair, is another vice commander on the ship's wife, who was just there with them for the day. She's not a part of the permanent crew. Anyway, so I just thought it was really interesting and fascinating, and I enjoyed the book immensely. Then we flash forward to 2001. And I'm introduced to an elderly couple, and the first words out of the wife's mouth was, you know, Craig, they live in Arizona, and she says, you know, we see flying saucers all the time, and she said, you know, our friend Dr. Frank, and I just looked at her strangely, and I said, Stranges? And she said, yeah, you want to meet him? Just like that. And I said, sure. So literally the following week, I was sitting having lunch with him. And I thought it was just going to be one of those lunches where you go, you know, you're a fan for the lunch, and we would part ways. And we actually became fast friends. And I literally saw him every single week and talked to him almost every day on the phone until his passing in November of 2008. So how I sort of got involved in it, I never set out to make a movie about Stranger at the Pentagon, but it all came about through, shall we say, interesting circumstances. Not long after I met him, Dr. Frank called me and said a gentleman wanted to make the book into a movie, and he said, since you have been in the business your whole life, would you come to the meeting with me, because I don't know about such things and I want to make sure I'm doing everything correctly. And I said, sure. So I went to the meeting. I looked the gentleman up, and he had no credits whatsoever for producing movies or anything. So after the meeting, he was very nice. After the meeting, I called him up, and I asked him if he could send Dr. Frank and myself his credentials, you know, his resume, and you know, what his plans were. And he says, well, I don't do business that way. I only do it on a handshake. And I said, well, we are actually in Hollywood. I said, I'm not going to let Dr. Frank do business with you on a handshake. So I said goodbye to him, and I didn't want to call Dr. Frank, but I went and had lunch with him to tell him in person. And a tear actually fell down his eyes, you know, down his cheeks. And I didn't realize how dear it was to him that he had always dreamed about having, you know, the book made into a movie. For those who have read the book, it's gone through many incarnations since it was released in 1967. It's basically his stories of meeting Valiant Thor and some of the crew and where the ships are stationed and a lot of that. And I told Dr. Frank, I said, you know, it's not a book that you can actually make a movie from, because there's not a structure. There's not a, you know, I said, we have a main storyline. And as I was doing that, I just kept getting impressions and ideas and that. And then I just kept talking to him, and I said, well, how about if we do this? I said, if we do a screenplay, I said, we can do it from two vantage points. We could do one where it's from your eyes looking, you know, going through this journey, or it's Valiant Thor's eyes going through his journey during the 3 years at the Pentagon. And I said, I think through Valiant Thor's eyes with you as a secondary character makes more sense, because I think that's what the public wants to see, and he agreed. So long story short, I started writing, you know, I started writing questions and things, and I would give them to Dr. Frank, and he would give it to them, and then I would start getting ideas and formulations, and then I'd sit with Dr. Frank, and he'd tell me stories, and then I would come up, you know, I came up with the first draft after a while, and I gave it to him, and he said that he gave it to Val, who just held it and absorbed it for a moment and said, just tell him he did a good job. And I said, that's it, no notes, you know, you know. So, and he goes, nope, that's all he said. And then the next morning I woke up and all the notes were downloaded into my head, just like, you know, like a streaming consciousness. And yep. I would go in and fix them. And with each draft throughout the years, that's how it started. You know, so I would give it to Dr. Frank in a hard copy form. I would have all the notes downloaded the following morning. And thus began my adventure, you know, with these incredible beings who are who are fully conscious, who are living in complete unconditional love. Because as I was writing the script, each one of them on the crew would come to me and share their feeling body with me, so I would understand who they were from their soul. It's like when Dr. Frank said that when he met Valiant for the first time, he said when he looked at me, he looked through me, and I knew he knew everything about me. So they were doing the opposite with me, as they were injecting themselves into me so that I would understand who they were and that I could write from their perspective. So it was a really beautiful experience. I will say it was so beautiful that, you know, many of the times when that would happen, I would sit and just sob because they were so beautiful. You know, and I'm talking about, you know, their heart and their soul energy. So
yes, quite an amazing energy to feel.
Yes, it's really, really amazing. And interestingly enough, I had a show come here to film me talking about Valiant Thor, and it took them like 5 hours to set up, and the host was a man and a woman. And I started going into the unconditional love aspect of them, and this wave of unconditional love came down like in a beam. And both the hosts were sobbing profusely, and I turned and I looked at all the crew, and they had tears just running down their eyes. And I said, see, this is so incredible that this is happening. I said, because I only ever get to tell what it feels like. They're actually allowing you to experience it. You know, it really was, and it took them quite some time to pull it together, I might add, you know, because it was such a beautiful, heartwarming experience. So that's how you know, that's how I came to be a part of it. And I love Dr. Frank dearly. Just one of the kindest, most genuine human beings on the planet. And, you know, and I miss him so much. You know, but he was there back in the days of, even in the George Van Tassel days, which I didn't even know, because he was asked to go back and do UFOs, retro UFO space conventions out at Giant Rock in the Integratron. I think the last time that I went with them might have been 2006 or 2007. And then they asked me to go along and speak as well. But he used to host all of the UFO conventions there even before he met Valiant Thor in the 50s, which I had no idea that he was a part of that.
Yeah, that's a weird synchronicity with that.
Yeah, that's
fascinating, just how he was doing that beforehand, and this comes into being now. I'm not sure which one of you would like to go into it, but just for the listeners and the viewers who haven't heard about this story before, would you like to tell us how this came into being, how this happened, how a human extraterrestrial, you know, got into the Pentagon and communicated with the U.S. government over a period of 3 years, I think it was, wasn't it?
Yes, and it's and it even goes beyond being a human extraterrestrial. He's a created being, which is what we would call angelic, you know, from that realm that is here to actually help the human race. You know, a lot of people get it mixed up. They think that, you know, he was like conspiring or something with the government. He was actually here to help the whole human race, and during that 3 years that he was there, that was a part of his mission. And but the story in a short nutshell, and then I'll let Paola take over, is on March 16th, 1957, it was a Saturday morning, it was actually Patricia Nixon's birthday, at 8 a.m. in his flagship Victor 1, he landed in an agricultural field in Virginia, which was about 20 minutes from the Pentagon, by the way. And there were calls into the police station. There was a police car with two police officers who arrived on the scene, and they pulled up in their car with their guns drawn behind their doors. And when Valiant Thor walked out and they looked at him and they just saw this unbelievable, overwhelming, unconditional love flowing from him, they literally just dropped their weapons, dropped their hands, and walked over and talked with him. And he said that he had an important message for the president and that he wanted to be taken to him. So they radioed ahead to the Pentagon, and they took him there first, and when he was there, they called the White House, and Eisenhower, the Joint Chiefs, and Nixon was late because it was Pat's birthday, you know, because this was a Saturday and they were all being called in. And, you know, around noon is when he arrived there, and they all felt the same exact thing when they saw him. And Eisenhower had such a great feeling towards him. He put him immediately on VIP status, which was for the 3 years. That first night, Valiant Thor spent he spent the night in the Army reception office until they got a room ready for him and, you know, earth clothes and all of that stuff from the era. And anyway, you know, so then throughout all this time, it was him, you know, talking with all the powers that be about this design that would be to, you know, help the human race and to, you know, and what exactly was in that proposal, I don't know how what was worded or what the implications were on how to do it, and neither did Dr. Frank. But in the long run, it was turned down because, you know, to the plan was to eliminate poverty, sickness, disease, and to prolong life. And you know, the end result. Did not. Nixon and Eisenhower were for it, from what Dr. Frank told me, and they championed it. And actually, Nixon really championed it because he's the one that also became close to Val during that time, because Eisenhower had a lot of things, you know, on his plate at you know during those 3 years. Although that you know that they met many times as well, but. But it all boiled down to that it would put, you know, pharmaceutical companies, hospitals, doctors, nurses, you know, everybody out of business, and it would throw the economy into, you know, a horrific state. So, so that's sort of, you know, that's the story of it in a nutshell. You know, I'm sure there is a whole lot more that went on during those times. But he left on March 16th, 1960, and he returned here March 16th, 1961, and from what Dr. Frank has said, that he has been here with his complement of Victor class fleet, I think up to, I think there's 287 of them stationed in and around the Earth on top of a gigantic starship, which is 14 miles long and 7 miles wide, that had to actually be built in outer space. So, and there are wonderful artist renderings of all of those as well. So people can check it out, by the way, on the website that I have for the movie StrangerAtThePentagon.com. So, and by the way, the book is out of print. And it is going for like $300 on Amazon. The original book, yeah, the original Stranger at the Pentagon book, the white cover is going for $1,000. So if anybody is interested, you know, I have the remaining copies left. If they're on the Stranger at the Pentagon website and they click on Help Fun Short Film, you know, for a small donation, they can get a brand new copy of the book and other books by Dr. Strange's, or copies of the movie when it's done, the short film and all that. They can just look at all the stuff that's available there for, you know, different tiers of donations and things. So in the short film, just where it is now, we've already shot it. It's in the can, and we are almost halfway through with visual effects. We have 68 visual effects in the entire movie. So it's taking quite some time, and they're absolutely spectacular. The effects that are rolling off, and it'll probably, the short film will be under under 25 minutes, and it's the main storyline with a cliffhanger ending for the short film, and then a wonderful little piece of film that I have Dr. Frank, in his own words, talking about meeting Valiant Thor for the first time back at the Pentagon on December 24th, 1959. So, so it's, you know, it's really, really exciting. And Mrs. Strange is, I've shown her some of the stuff, and she has just been weeping tears of quite beautiful joy. So, you know, it's real exciting to see it all come to life.
Oh, it would be. It would be working on it for so long, having to be, you know, a part of what's going on. The story itself, you know, it's a fascinating thing, and you know, you'd feel proud of yourself as you're going along with the group of people that are working with you, because it's a big project.
It is a big project, and you know, I have to tell you, I started off doing the short film. Just, you know, I'm using it as a springboard to raise the money for the feature-length film, which is already set and ready to go. All we're waiting for is, you know, the short film to be done and then to be presented in the package. But, you know, when I started out, I had a little, you know, I had a little Canon camera that we were going to shoot on, you know, and I was thinking, gosh, it would be so great to have a Red camera, but, you know, they're so expensive and they cost like $10,000 just to insure. And literally 2 days later, a DP walked, came to me and said he would do it, and he had his own Red camera, and we wouldn't have to, you know, we wouldn't have to insure it or do anything like that. So, you know, and then I even had James Cameron's visual effects coordinator jump on board and walk us through it. He did our whole green screen and, you know, had huge people. The spacesuits that were designed were actually put together by a gentleman called Gilberto Guzman over at Eastern Costume, and I found out that Gilberto is the one who built the original Star Trek uniforms for the first Star Trek movie. So, you know,
so there's so a bit of a tie to some pretty up there people that are into, you know, that field, visual effects and all yes. that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Well, what I'm also just trying to say is that it's been a beautiful and easy process, because I really feel that we're having some wonderful divine intervention in bringing this all, you know, to the forefront. Just like, you know, even Paola coming into my life and knowing Paola and, you know, and working together to bring these wonderful stories. You know, a lot of people don't know about George Van Tassel and, you know, a lot of the people from that era, Gabriel Green, and, you know, there was a lot of contactees way back then, and Howard and Connie Menger were having major contacts beyond, they were having contacts with beings from all over the universe, just not one specific planet. You know, yep. And by the way, you know, a lot of people roll their eyes when they say there's life in our universe. What they don't understand is that the rest of the universe lives on the interiors of their planets, because they have learned how to do these things called synchrotron skies. And they can control their temperature, they can control the perfect setting, and these are all the settings in the resonance fields that keep them young and keep them rejuvenated. And those were a part of that technology was given to George Van Tassel way back when he built the Integratron. So they're smart, because, you know, we all live in the outer elements out here, right? So all the planets are like these incredible spaceships where they can take them and they can even make them all different floors with different settings. You know, they have the God code, as I call it, that can create an outdoor setting. Like, you know, we think of it as Star Trek and a holodeck, but it's not even a holodeck. It's actually real. Even on the starship, Dr. Frank said there's a forest with waterfalls and running water and animals and the most incredible things, and, you know, and it's real, you know, so it's quite fascinating.
Yeah, it is. Now we'll get you back in, Paola. You were starting to get talk about before how this started to fascinate you with the work that you were doing.
Yeah.
Would you like to go a bit more into that, how this came?
Yeah, and I'm gonna connect with Craig again, because what happens is this. If you study this, I mean, if you study the history of ufology, and you know I'm a teacher, I have a master's in education, and if you study the history of contact, you must go back to the future. That's why I'm going to do something on this in November 14th, 15th, and 16th about this, and I'm going to call it Back to the Future. And we're going to look at the early contactees, the ones that Craig just mentioned, the ones that met the human-type aliens. Now, why is that dangerous? Well, I remember having a long conversation with Colonel Philip Corso, and he said to me, you know, Paula, he said, we know there's extraterrestrial biological entities. They're like little clones, he said. But at the Pentagon, we weren't worried about them. We were worried about the creators because they could mix with us and we couldn't tell the difference.
So he used the same terminology, like Craig was saying about the create, like the creators, how you were just saying then. Corso used that same...
He used EB, the extraterrestrial biological entity, but he said the creators were the ones that they were worried about because the creators or the people like us are the ones that everybody, because they could just mix, they could be sitting next to you at a restaurant, and they are. And that I found out very, you know, I found out by interviewing Colin Andrews, who told me that he was in a hotel in England and he saw a gentleman that he felt was not from here, and telepathically he said, take your index finger and put it on the right side of your nose if you are not from here, and the man did just that.
Yeah.
And then I interviewed, that was Timothy Good, I'm sorry, that was Timothy Good who said that.
About the same, it sounded similar to what Timothy Good was saying, yeah.
That was Timothy Good, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And then I interviewed Colin Andrews, who told me he met one of these people in a hotel in Washington, D.C. during the X conference, because the man came right up to him and said, Colin, it is time for you to tell the people about your contact experience. So when I realized, not only from my Italian stories, but from the Latin American contactees, that the aliens, the ones that are visiting this planet, are mostly observing. They're like anthropologists because they come to this planet and we are at a certain stage of history, and they're able to mix with people and learn about us without we can detect them. And if they want to go to the future, they go to a more evolved planet and they mix with those people. This comes also from the Adamski tapes that I've been listening to, where George Adamski said, and this goes with what Craig just said, you know, what's his name? Valiant Thor was not at the Pentagon on vacation. I mean, this isn't what he chose to have a holiday. He basically was there to offer help. And Adamski's contacts with the Venusians, with people from Venus like Orthon, they told him that they wanted us in 1950s, now you got to put this in historical perspective, to change from a war economy to a travel among the stars space economy.
Yep.
So, and if we had done that, if we had spent all the money that we're spending on a war economy to travel among the stars, to create spaceships, to create environments, we would, Adamski said, you'll make money. You'll make all kinds of money. You'll have new industry. You'll have all kinds of wonderful things happening if you switch this economy. And then, guess what? You guys can get off the planet. You can not only get off the planet, you can travel. You can travel among the stars, because right now how we're involved, we're just stuck on the planet.
Yes. Well, that's the point, and that's come up with so many experiences. Going from switching the economy, and people say it would crash overnight, but if it was done in such a way where it's easy to overlap. The benefits from free energy to cleaning up the environment to actually better forms of technology, all these things could come into play, but it's just the mechanism to switch that to get that into place. But it's very similar, to what, you know, all the contactees back then basically were saying in about switching the economies. Now, Bob Dean, I don't know him personally, but I've heard him in interviews talking about beings being in the Pentagon, walking around. You hear other military whistleblowers go on about the same thing, which is sort of what grabbed my attention when hearing this story also. Is there any other sort of stories that you've heard or people you've interviewed where it's been a very similar story, if not the same, or validation backing up this claim of Valiant Thor being in the Pentagon communicating with the presidents, the military, and so forth?
As far as aliens being in among us, there's all kinds of them. And the one that I interviewed is the Maurizio Cavallo case. On my Facebook, I've put all the Polaroids that Maurizio gave me. He lives in near Torino, in Turin, in Italy. And he took Polaroids of these people, and they're people. So I'm going to stop calling them aliens. I think we're the aliens. You know, they're people. And he told me that when I interviewed him, and I had a hard time with this. I got to tell you, Peter, this isn't easy for me because I've been brainwashed like everybody else to believe in alien racism. There's reptilians and grays and Nordics, and that's it. And that is the most ignorant kind of classification of people I can imagine, because I hope they don't do that with us. I hope they don't go back and say there are three kinds. But anyway, the thing is that... What I did.
Dumb and dumberer.
Yeah, there's like three kinds of humans. Yeah. But, you know, when I did the Maurizio Cavallo case, and it was quite difficult, I went back three times. I saw his Polaroids. I saw his movies. He said to me, "You know why you're here?" And I said, "No." He said, "My contact, Sewell, who looks like a Hollywood actor, like Balthor," he said, "I met him in a cafe in Rome. He said he had a leather jacket on. He's from Clarion. They live in a villa where they create their own food. And by the way, most of these people are vegetarian. Howard Menger's people were vegetarian. The Clarions are vegetarian. The Amicizia group only ate fruit and vegetables." But he said, "My contact, Sewell," he said, "3 years before you appeared here," he said, "to my house, he said there would be an American journalist that will come in and knock on your door. You let her in because we call her the bridge." And I was in total shock because they were talking about me. They knew 3 years from then I would have gone to do the Cavallo story, the Maurizio Cavallo story. And they know that I'll do it as objectively as possible. I don't get emotionally involved and become, you know, a guru or anything. I just do the story. And so that case in Italy opened up the doors. But I told Craig just the other day, and this is not a coincidence, a friend of mine, Regina Meredith, was sitting with a woman in Sedona, Arizona, who had met Balthor at the age of 13. Her father was an intelligence person. She said that she had had contact when she was a little girl, that her mother sent her into the desert with a group of Edgar Cayce people. And while they were there, she said they were all talking about, because you got to remember that the 50s was the atom bomb scare. We all had to hide under our desks and stuff. We thought the bomb was going to come down. In the 50s, they were afraid of Russia, you know, just lobbying the atom bomb, having it, you know, just destroying America. And she said she was with this group in the desert. A car pulls up. Two men come out. She said one man, she said, looked like a Hollywood actor. He had a full suit on, and she couldn't believe it. They were in the desert. And the other man had horn-rimmed glasses. And she told me the date. It was 1958. And she said, she was 13. She remembers she looked straight at him. He looked right through her. He had the most beautiful voice in the world. And he said, "We will not allow that to happen here." And she, when she saw my Facebook photos, and I will send you the photos that August Roberts took of Val Thor on Howard Menger's property. I will send them to you so you can show them to your listeners or whoever watches your video show. She said that was Val Thor, and she recognized them from the pictures that I put on the Facebook, and she said he looked right through her, and the dates kind of coincide, so I think that Val did not just stay in the Pentagon. If he was sitting on Howard Menger's property, I think he left the Pentagon a couple of times, and and I truly believe that just like Howard Menger at the end of his book talks about keeping our body alkaline in order to avoid disease, and that's what the people from Venus told him. So these people are telling us how to live longer, to keep our body alkaline. They're telling us how we can change our war economy. These messages were so powerful in the 50s that somebody out there has twisted this whole UFO contact thing to make it just the alien abduction scenario. So that's what Craig and I have been talking about. And I think if we go back to Craig, what's interesting is, Craig, tell them how Dr. Strange's met Val Thor in the Pentagon, that whole thing with the opening of the lapel, which reminds me of Obi-Wan Kenobi. Tell them about that.
Yes. He was actually doing a two-week lecture at a church in Washington, D.C. that December of 1959. And one of the nights his lecture was on UFOs and the Bible. Now, he was very good friends with August Roberts, who was a retired Air Force photographer and one of the top ufologists at that time. Augie, as they called him for short, had the largest collection of flying saucer photographs from all over the world. So he was there present that day on the Menger farm, and when he saw Valiant Thor and Dawn and Jill, he said the same thing. When he looked at them, he looked right through them, you know, but he said what Valiant Thor didn't have were any palm or fingerprints, and he spoke in many languages, and so he went and told Dr. Frank this story, and so Dr. Frank actually blew up a picture of him and put it on his board, right? And when he would go and do these lectures, and at the end of the lecture, after he would talk about all the flying saucer photographs, he would say, you know, and this is supposedly a picture of a gentleman from another planet. And interestingly enough, Mrs. Strange's the other day just gave me all of those. She found all of those giant photographs, most of them laminated, and gave them to me so I can use them in the big movie. So interestingly enough, just on a sidebar, so I put the one of Alien Thor up in my bedroom, and the very next day I met William Shatner, Captain Kirk. I just thought that was a little ironic.
That is a bit trippy.
Yes. I had met him many years before, but I just thought that was interesting. But anyway, so while he was giving this lecture, when it was done, he had a book out at the time called Flying Saucerama, which was all about the UFO flying saucer photographs and stories of contactees, etc. He was signing books, and a woman came up to him and said, "I have to speak with you right away." He said, "You know, I'm a little busy right now. Can it wait?" And then she whipped out a Pentagon badge, and he said, "You have my undivided attention." And he looked for someone there and said, "Where could I go and talk with her?" So they took him in a back room where they had a conversation, and she actually had pointed to the Valiant Thor photograph, and she said, "He wants to meet with you." And anyway, long story short, she picked him up the following morning at his hotel at 8 a.m. They went to the Pentagon. She was one of the secretaries with a high clearance level. And she had also, while there, Valiant Thor had befriended her. So they were also quite close. So, you know, they get up to the thing, and Dr. Frank's like really nervous. You know, he says, "You know, how am I going to get in there? I don't have a badge." And she said, "Just do what I do." And she got up to the thing and she flashed her coat open. Remember, it's December, it's cold, you know. She opens her coat, and Dr. Frank does the same thing and walks right by. And then they come upon the second station, guard station, and he says, "Oh my gosh, you know, one time maybe, twice, never, you know." And she goes, "No, just do what I do." Did the same thing, walked on by, and then she took him down some corridors and just opened a blank, you know, just a nondescript door, opened it, and straight ahead were some desks bumped up to each other. There were two guys working on typewriters there. Dr. Frank, you know, cleared his throat. He tried to do everything to get their attention. They never looked at him once. So behind the door was a little seating area, and as he closed the door, you know, she had basically said to him, you know, when you're done, just leave the same way you came in, because he was worried about getting out of there, you know, and you know, she joked with him, and she said, you're some field investigator, just do the same thing as you did when you came in, you know, so... Anyway, he came walking up with a powerful booming voice and said, hello, Frank. And they actually sat down and had a conversation. And, you know, the conversation was primarily personal things about Dr. Frank that he didn't even know about. One being that his parents gave birth to a baby boy before him, and the baby died at birth. And that actually Dr. Frank, when he was born, was going the same way. And it was intimated that he was given a little help. So anyway, he had never heard that story. So when he went back to New Jersey, and remember, you know, we Italian families know Italian families. They're very dramatic, yeah. And they're not emotional, or they're overly emotional, but the stuff that is painful, you never talk about it, ever. So when he asked his mother and father at the table, his mother, Catherine, started crying profusely, and she ran out of the room, and his father, Natali, said, you know, yes, it's true, and, you know, and he found it hard to believe the story of Valiant Thor. He had a great line that Dr. Frank used to say. He says, oh, Mamma Mia, you come home with the flying sausages, you know, instead of flying saucers. He goes, the people are going to think the strangers of family is a strange. So, but interestingly enough, years later, Valiant Thor paid his parents a visit, and they didn't even know it was him until he was gone. So that's a whole other sort of interesting story that actually is not in the book. But Natali was down in the Italian marketplace. You know, you went to the meat market for the meat, you went to the vegetable for the produce, and you went to the bakery for the baked goods. So yes. As his arms were filling, a gentleman came up and said, can I help you with your bag? He spoke to him in perfect Italian, by the way. And he thought, what a nice boy you are, you know? And they're talking and talking and talking. And he says, well, here, let me go on the train or the bus, you know, whatever they took back then, with you. I'll help you with the groceries home. And they're having a lovely conversation. And he asked him, he says, Frank's name came up. He goes, oh, you know my boy Frank? He said, yes, I know him. So... You know, so he went to the house. He helped them put all the groceries. He met, you know, the mother, and they invited him to stay for dinner. But of course, he said he couldn't. And then they watched him walk down the street, and he vanished. They actually watched him vanish, and they both went, and they ran and got the Stranger at the Pentagon book, and they went, it's a him. So they had, I just thought that was great that they allowed his parents to have that confirmation. So, you know, so he wouldn't have to go through life with them not believing him, because, you know, he was back in the early days where there were people who were emphatic that, you know, these things don't happen, and we're the superior race in the universe, and, you know, all those kinds of things. So I just thought it was really interesting.
I love that story. I've never heard that story before. I'm so glad you told it.
Yeah.
Is there other stuff you've come across that wasn't in the book that sort of opened your eyes a little bit, made you think, or just sort of connected the dots on some more of this story?
Yeah, there's several things that sort of, you know, pushed me along as well. You know, there was an Air Force pilot at the Pentagon, and he had severe ulcers and was grounded. And one day, Valiant was walking down the corridor, and this gentleman with another gentleman was walking down the corridor. Val was with somebody, I don't know who. And he stopped, and he put his hands on the gentleman's forehead, and I believe on his stomach. And the man just felt this heat. And Dr. Frank had heard this story from Valiant Thor. Anyway, when he was supposed to have an operation the next day, and he said, please, you know, take x-rays to be sure. And they said, well, we don't know what happened, but there's no ulcer anymore. So he was able to fly again. And this gentleman in the 70s came to a Dr. Frank lecture and said, I'm the man that Valiant Thor healed. So, of course, I've tried, you know, I tried to find out what the gentleman's name was. But, you know, so much time has passed, you know, that, you know, we can't find out. But hopefully one of his family members will come forward, as many people are coming forward, saying that they had met him throughout, you know, throughout these years. There's another lady who met him when she was 16, who I spoke with, who met him on two occasions where he was teaching people in a small group. And anyway, I just thought that was fascinating. But you know, the things that I think really were powerful for me is on the first day of writing the script, I had a very lucid dream with Valiant Thor where I actually, Dr. Frank always tried to describe his voice somewhere between extreme compassion and with the strength, with a real incredible strength behind it, you know? And I had a dream of him coming to me, and he spoke to me and showed me the path of the movie, and that they were clearing the way. And it always, you know, always resonated with me. And I would feel him from time to time, more over the crew members than him through the writing process, although I could feel him overlooking it. It's strange to say that, but that was always my impression. And then when he would come, and you would feel him, the energy was much different than the crew members because, you know, he's a created being and the love is even heightened, you know, in that realm. So, and you know, I can only imagine what consciousness that must be even in a brain of a created beings. But, you know, and then on the last day of writing it, many, many, many years later, I called Dr. Frank to ask him a few questions. I was just writing the summations at the end. And he had his "There's Somebody Else in the Room" voice on, which I always knew, you know, because his voice changed. All right, I'll ask him, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, one of those things. And then all of a sudden in the background, I heard a man start answering the questions. And then Dr. Frank burst out laughing. He goes, well, he's actually sitting right here. And so I would ask the question. I would hear him answer it. Dr. Frank didn't even have to repeat it. You know, it's not that he handed him the phone, but he would repeat it. And then Dr. Frank would repeat it. And then I got the answers. And then I said, well, thank you so much. And I hung up the phone and I was like, what did I just do? You know, I was like, you know, it was like when I said, was that like, what was that, a Jedi mind swipe? You know? You know, so, but you know, there was another one, Teal, who is a vice commander. There's four vice commanders on the ship. There's Vice Commander Dawn, who is photographed. There's Vice Commander Teal, Vice Commander Thawne, and Vice Commander Zan, Z-A-N-N. And Zan is Jill's husband, the lady who was photographed there. And then there is another, there are two other complements besides the regular crew, which shifts out about every 3 months. is Yanaya, who is another created being out of Melchizedek, and his associate's name is Yo, which is actually spelled Y-E-O. So you will see them also in the short film and in the feature length film. Years before I met Dr. Frank, I have always been visited by master teachers since I woke up at 26, and and who have shared great spiritual information and stuff. But I did have this woman pop in once in a meditation, and what the sensation is as you're meditating, the back of your neck, you get a click, it goes just like that, and then boom, they're just like I'm looking at you guys on the screen, they're right there looking back at me, and yeah. then it's gone. And I'm sure everybody has, you know, similar experiences or the same. And I just always thought she was really neat. She was in a tight powder blue uniform standing in front of a giant silver flying saucer. And anyway, I came to find out almost 10 years later that was Teal. So I had, and the strange thing is it was them who connected me to Dr. Frank, because all I kept seeing was before I met Dr. Frank for months, and I hadn't thought about the book in a very long time, is every time I walked by my couches in the living room, I could feel the resonation of Valiant Thor and his crew members sitting there. And every hair on my body would stand on end. And this went on for a couple of months, and then I met the couple, the elderly couple who connected me to Dr. Frank, and I realized they were connecting me to Dr. Frank to put this into a movie form, you know, and you know how it all happens sort of naturally and excitedly. But during that long course, there was one time that I had become very sick, and I ate something. And for 3 days, my stomach was in knots, and then I was in such pain that I had to have somebody rush me to the doctor. While I was there at the doctor, they kept me there all day trying to give me things for my stomach so I would either throw up or do something, you know. And then they decided that they rushed me in an ambulance to the hospital that night. They did x-rays, and they said that I had a bowel obstruction and that they were going to have to operate in the morning. And as you know, you never want anybody operating on your intestines because, you know, you're messed up for life. Well, that evening, as I was sleeping in the hospital, I woke up and my eyes were closed, and I could feel Teal standing over me, and through all my intestines, water bubbles were going through it. I could feel them going through it, and that when I woke up in the morning, I would be okay. And even with that thought, so when I went back to sleep and I woke up, I don't know, around 8 a.m. maybe, and I was on my side and I looked over, and sitting in the chair was Dr. Frank. And he said, Teal called me this morning. She told me she fixed you right up last night. And of course, they did x-rays, and I the obstruction was gone, and I walked out of the hospital, I think around 2 o'clock that afternoon.
You're all fixed.
Yeah, all fixed, so.
Well, you know, these are true stories, and Peter, it's very important, and I'm glad you're interviewing Craig, because these are true. This is all true stuff. When Craig keeps talking about unconditional love and consciousness, it's a normal emotion. I mean, when I was interviewing the Latin American contactees, like Ricardo Gonzalez, he said this. He said that there is only two emotions, love and fear, and that these people are so evolved, and I'm going to call them people, that they have decided that it is better to go to Latin America because those people have a heart connection, and people like his contact, who's named Antarel, can connect with them on a heart level. Whereas if they came here, if they came back to Giant Rock, if they came back to Southern California, the only thing that the United States is interested in is the technology. They care about the ship and how the ship runs. They are not interested in what is inside the ship and who's visiting. So that made such sense to me, because these people have evolved consciousness, and the only way we can have a conversation with them is if we get a clue, if we evolve a little bit ourselves, so we could be on the almost the same level. And so the Latin American people are big-hearted people, and that is why so many Latin American contactees are having real human alien experiences today in 2014 as we speak, and they haven't come back to Giant Rock. And I talked to Craig about this. I said, Craig, you and I are going down to Giant Rock. We're going to meditate. We're going to ask them to come back because we need the help. So Craig and I have been talking about meditation to try to get them to come back here, because there are certain people that do care about the extraterrestrials and not just the propulsion system.
So right, true. And go on, Craig, you're right.
I was just going to say, you know, it's interesting. You know, they may be extraterrestrials to us, but we're extraterrestrials to them. So if you look at it from the standpoint that we're all one universal society, and we are just humanity across the whole width and breadth of the universe. So they look at it like that, and that's the way that we really need to be looking at it, because we are going to become joined with universal society. We are going to become joined with them. It is inevitable. And, you know, we're just first taking all these little baby steps now. But, you know, if we really look from the 70s, you know, up until now, how quickly and how fast the consciousness actually has raised among the people, you know. And yes, there are, you know, there are spiritual people in the government. There really and truly are. I mean, I don't know people in the government, but I know that there are. And I know it's like when somebody sees somebody hurting an animal, you want to go to its rescue, but sometimes you can't because there might be a fence there, you know. And I think it might be the same for, you know, some of these people as well. But I really do see that thread, you know, coming together. From my many years of having these incredible connections, you know, to master teachers and things. I wrote a book which is actually called The Autobiography of an Extraterrestrial Saga, and then it is subtitled I Am Tehran, which it's about the lead guy, Tehran. And it's about universal society and the program to raise consciousness on Earth that is coming out of Melchizedek, which is the universe's spiritual university. And it's all about duality, because all of the fully conscious beings out there, like all of the crew members on Victor 1, they're all fully conscious. We're all living in duality. We haven't learned quite yet how to merge our light and our dark and our thoughts. So the whole book is not only on the duality for one's own self, but it is also the greater duality of the universe. And it's, you know, it's also quite thought-provoking. So where Stranger at the Pentagon is about a great story about Valiant Thor in conjunction with the Earth, the Autobiography of an Extraterrestrial Saga is about the universal society and their consciousness and how they live in their spiritual technology. Their technology is not like regular technology. It's spiritual technology, which is even unbelievably
cool. Some of
it is
just a lot of people can't fathom. Like some of the beings I interact with, the crafts are actually just consciousness. And
they
can
are.
Manifest
yes.
and project it how they want it to. So, yeah, there's been
That's
crafts
right.
have been on that are just pure light, and I don't know how I've been on there physically or not. I'm like worked it out later. I'm sort of just writing this book, my fifth book now, about this interaction I had, where if I defocused off the ground, I could actually see through the bottom of the craft and I could see the roof of my house and the trees and the alleyway. And if I defocused off that, I again could see the light underneath me. So when it comes to these, like, there are, you know, physical type crafts, but they're all using some type of interdimensional technology. There are beings from this dimension. There are others from higher planes. But there's that common thing where it is consciousness with the craft, with their societies. It's a higher level of consciousness than, unfortunately, what we've got here.
Right. And even a really cool thing is in the Turan book as well, is on one of the big motherships, it's interdimensionally layered within all the dimensions. And if you focus and want to go from one dimension of the craft to the next, you actually see people folding in and out of the different layers, going into the fifth, sixth, seventh dimensions and things like that. It's actually quite spectacular and really cool.
Yeah, no, it's like even when I go out and do, you could say, CE5, it's contact work, and we meditate, invite the beings. You know, it was only 3 nights ago I did the last one, and I took 2 people out, and there was probably about 10 sightings we had that night. But there's times where the atmosphere will change where we're standing, and I walk out, and when I turn around, the atmosphere is back to what it was, and you can just see just like a mist coming off a road on a hot day. You can just see the craft, and you can see, oh, there's a craft right there. That's why, you know, the atmosphere changed. And then you walk back in, and sometimes you can pick up on beings. You can see more of the structure in the mist form. And then, you know, back again, when inside it, it's just different atmosphere. Yeah. So there's so many different aspects to it, but it's something that's never ending. And that's the thing where there's a lot of people in this field where they, you know, there's a lot of ego and there's a lot of this is the way it is, but the more you know yourself, the more that you learn and the more that you get in touch, the more you realize you don't know, but that really you do know, but you're relearning it again.
Yes, and that the more, it goes back to that old adage, the more you know, the less you know, because the consciousness never ends. And every society has many different ways of using technologies and spiritual technologies and different ways of interacting. And, you know, but it's quite, you know, it's really quite exciting, you know.
Yeah, it is.
Peter, I'd like to add something to that mist story, too, because I interviewed 4 contactees from Latin America, Sixto Paz from Peru, Luis Fernando from Bolivia, Ricardo Gonzalez, who's in Argentina, and another gentleman, Calderon from Peru. Now, what they told me was when they meet these people, something called a Zendra happens, a mist that's like a dome. It's like a dome mist, and this dome just appears, and you walk inside the dome, and it changes the atmosphere, and the person is standing inside the dome and comes towards them. And what I'd like to do, if it's okay, I'd like to tell you that my website is www.paolaharris.com, and those interviews are on my website, the one with Ricardo Gonzalez and Sixto Paz, talking about their contact has been translated into English, and it's on my website. So
fantastic. There'll be a link up to there as well, both of your website and Stranger at the Pentagon. That's fascinating.
Yeah, because we got to understand that this phenomenon is not an American phenomenon.
Oh, it's everywhere, and people have seen that in my house, like the mist, even beings appearing as mist, and it's happening everywhere. And the more I've talked to people around the world, I've found that that's a very common thing with the mist. But it's a worldwide thing, and it's really not about the crafts. That's what I tell people when I take them out. If you're out there to see the crafts, forget about it, because it's about connecting on a higher level. And a lot of people that come out with me after then, they're never the same, because something's activated in them. You know, there's whether it's stuff in your third eye, beings down on the, you know, there's many things that come from it, and that's what it's about. It's about raising yourself to connect, and yeah. these guys will help meet you halfway because they see that you're making an effort.
Yes.
But there's a lot going on, like especially South America. There's a darn lot of sometimes hundreds up to 1,000 UFOs in the sky at once. Down here on the East Coast, there's a lot going on as well as in Europe.
Yeah, but in Latin America, I think a lot is going on. And again, I'm going to say it's because whatever is visiting or whoever is visiting wants a heart connection.
Yeah.
They can reach your heart. They can reach your emotion. I think it's very important that anybody that study the UFO phenomenon in general read everyone's books, that they go to the source, that they read the interviews. And I'm going to add, again, any work I do, I don't ever add my opinion. I just get the story. I just ask very good questions. And what I'm learning just from the UFO field, the UFO researchers are the best researchers are doing consciousness studies.
Yeah.
And who has shifted into that is Grant Cameron and Colin Andrews. Both of them are doing consciousness. The Edge of Reality, Colin Andrews' book, is amazing. Grant Cameron is doing consciousness. He went from presidential UFO to consciousness studies, and that's the direction I'm going into.
Yep. Now, well, that's where it all leads to. At the end of the day, that's where it all leads to. And then, like I keep telling people, you can't change what's around you, but if you change what's within, that will project and manifest outside of yourself. And if we all just worked on ourselves individually, as a collective, the more of us that did it, that would appear and manifest more as in the society and elevate us to the next level. But it's just one of those things where it's slowly happening, and that's what's happening now is a lot of researchers are going to the consciousness field of study where 30 years ago, a lot of people thought that was a load of crap. From my understanding too, just hearing other interviews, and you knew Dr. Alan Hynek, apparently he, by the end of doing his studies, near the end of his time, he was actually heading that direction himself in his thoughts with what was going on apparently. Is there anything to that?
You meditate for about... I remember because, I went to visit them quite often, and we went on vacation together, and he would not be disturbed the first hour of when he woke up in the morning, and he would face the sun and meditate, and he went into heavy meditation, and I think that that's a sign of wisdom. I think that's a sign of just what you said, of looking within, and I think that's what our human family, Craig, our human family wants us to do. I won't call them extraterrestrials anymore.
Yeah, no, they really, it really is our human family, you know, and from, you know, they don't like to be called aliens because alien is sort of a negative connotation, but extraterrestrial is, you know, is more of the positive one. But then again, it's our human universal family.
Well, it is. There's a lot connected to us, and the way I understand it from the information that's been communicated to myself is that we're basically a mixture of a large amount of them and a little bit of ethereal DNA chucked in, and we are them and they are us, and that's why people wonder how come they got two arms and two legs and why do they manifest in a humanoid form, and it's like, well, think about it. We are them, they are us. There's no other way you can get around that, but it is. It's... That's the thing, it's a universal thing, and we're all one cell of the one consciousness. But, you know, it's good now that researchers like yourself are looking into that. You've been into that for a while because it's taken a while for the mainstream UFO field to even look at this. The same with hypnotherapy and other fields. It was laughed upon, and then it hits year 2000, and slowly, you know, things were looked at, and now it's, you know, more things are being looked at and considered, and now there is even evidence to validate a lot of these fields of study. So, as a collective, we're up, rising up a little bit.
Yes.
Definitely. All right, we'll end the show there. I'd like to thank yourself, Paula, and Craig for coming on the show and taking the time out, and... Yeah, I'll be putting the links up to stranger@thepentagon.com and paulaharris.com as well. And again, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you. Thank you. Go ahead, Paula.
Well, you know, I plan on working with Craig on this, and we should keep in touch, because when Craig does debut Stranger in the Pentagon, wherever he does it, I think a lot of people from Australia and from all over the world might be interested in coming to, I think it'll be in Hollywood or whatever, and getting involved in and looking at this other side of UFO studies, or this other side of cosmic research.
Yep.
Yes, and it will be the first movie ever from the era of the 1950 contactees.
The first one.
The first one, yeah. So they do have one in the works on George Van Tassel, but it hasn't been shot yet. So. But I just think it's fascinating, because all these men, you know, led really interesting lives back then. You know, they traveled all over the world speaking about this, and they were on, you know, radio shows and TV shows and, you know, everything under the sun, you know. And it was a much different time back then.
Definitely, definitely. Not, and the word still got around.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, what I do is I call it Back to the Future, and I on my Facebook, I've put the books, Adamski's books, the Van Tassel. You can go on YouTube and hear him speak about the Integratron, and I didn't realize that Howard Hughes actually helped finance that. So the Hollywood crowd was very much involved in the 1950s with the Space Brother movement, and also Howard Menger, who's very, very important. So these people, if you could go back to studying these people, I think you'll get the real story about contact.
Fantastic.
Yes. Yes. And Howard Hughes, by the way, used to fly in his little plane at Giant Rock Airport to go have burgers and apple pie at George Van Tassel's wife had a little tiny restaurant there. So... yeah, it must have been. I bet you it was a really interesting time.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Yeah, that's creepy. Yeah. Well, thanks again to both of you, and keep me in the loop, and we'll get you back on once it's, you know, let us know what's going on, and we'll do something.
Yeah, and let's put a couple of pictures of Val up where you, and maybe you can show them.
Yeah, I'll actually put them underneath this video, and with the audio version they can download at the website, so they can see them for themselves.
Okay,
yes, perfect. Absolutely. And they're also on Stranger at the Pentagon, along with videos that I've made about the story. And you can see, I think, Victor 1 and the blueprints on there, too, if you toggle through the pages.
Yep. Now, fantastic. Well, thanks again, and we'll talk soon.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay, bye.